Hola, mi nombre es Ana Ibáñez, soy la profesora coordinadora de la asignatura Aplicaciones Semánticas de la Lengua Inglesa y en esta sesión vamos a ver la unidad 3 on the Architecture of Words. So I'm going to switch to English. In this session, we are going to go through the main contents of the book course, which is called On the Architecture of Words. So what are we going to see? First, in the introduction, we have some of the contents of what we are going to see. We are going to see in this unit, we will find in the book, some basic notions about what morphology is and its units of analysis. Then morphology and its interaction with semantics, especially semantic morphology. And also a bit of how this interconnection can be applied to different kinds, especially to the application of lexicological databases of corpora that we will, which we will see at the end of the session, two of them. So first of all, what is morphology? Well, the term morphology was coined already in the 19th century by Goethe. He coined this term and he referred to it by the study of forms. So according to this term, this meaning, morphology is also, for instance, applied in biology, in medicine, because they also study forms. In linguistics, it is considered word grammar. Morphology is equitable, comparable to word grammar, which is the study of the components of words, basically. So the main, we are going to see now the scope of morphology, how to separate down a word, and then different other models to proposing a model of theory for morphology. Well, morphology basically is the study of the internal structure of words, which is what we have said, word grammar, and of words behavior, so word formation phenomena. So in morphology, we have two kinds of studies, the analysis of the components of words and the analysis of the new creation of words or the formation of words. A word then, which is also a synonym to lexical item, is composed of morphemes, basically. So what is a morpheme? A morpheme, first of all, is considered the smallest linguistic unit with a grammatical function. It also has some other definitions, which is the shortest, another one, for instance, is the shortest combination of articulatory subgestures, which is sounds, with meaning. So basically, if we join the two definitions together, we can say that a morpheme is the smallest, as we have here, the smallest linguistic unit with grammatical or semantic function. So the smallest functional linguistic unit. Basically, then it is connected to semantics and to syntax. So a morpheme, if we continue with this, can consist of one word, which is monosyllables, such as way, car, ball, not, yes, or the meaningful part of a word, such as ER, or in singer, we have sing, which is the base morpheme, or ER, which is the derivational morpheme. So all these morphemes we see cannot divide it into smallest unit meaningful parts. And if we continue with the example singer is an example that appears in the book, but we can find many others. For instance, I don't remember if it appears in the book, sorry, but we have so many glasses, for instance. Simple one, glasses would have glass and then es, the plural form. So morphemes can be free or bound. A free morpheme is a morpheme that can occur independently. For instance, ask, drive, the, up. Bound morphemes are the ones that need to be attached to other morphemes in order to exist. So a bound morpheme is synonym of affix. And we have different types of affixes. We have prefixes, suffixes, infixes, and circumfixes. Although in English, we only have prefixes and suffixes, for instance. There are two links here that you can find in the book. One of the links for prefixes is a very interesting webpage where you have the most, a list of prefixes that are used in English. And for suffixes, we also have here all the list of the main derivational suffixes in English. For instance, for drive, driver, act, action, all the different suffixes and the mean and the function they have, the meaning they provide. For infixes and circumfixes, we will see now in the next slide. Okay. It is interesting. There is something that has always called the attention of linguists and morphologists, which is locative particles. Because locative particles sometimes can be considered affixes and they can occur also independently. For instance, under or even up, under, on, in, inspire, underestimate, overtake, override, overreact, sub, because it cannot occur independently, but insulate, for instance. So, depending on the concept, they can be considered a bound morpheme or independent morpheme. So, this is very blurring sometimes, and here we have we have to find limits between compounding and derivation. So what are the criteria we can follow? Can the particle occur independently? For instance, underestimate is estimate somebody under something. So in this case, we can consider this a compound. This works for most of the cases, but sometimes it doesn't. For instance, in phrasal verbs, not in phrasal verbs, but in words, in lexicalized verbs, let's say. For instance, we have an example in the book, overtake, which is not the same as take over, meaningfully, meaning-wise. And also, we see that overtake has already, in terms of logical structure, it is a two-argument logical structure. Remember from the subject course semantics, you have seen, for instance, also in other areas, in Roland reference grammar or in functional grammar that we call arguments. For instance, there are verbs that are three argument verbs, which are the predicate and the arguments that this predicate needs in order to be realized. For instance, I comb my hair has two arguments. I, which is the subject, the action, and the undergoer. In Roman reference grammar, remember they talk about actor and undergoer, but we can also speak in other terms, more functional or even generative, and we can say a subject and a direct object, the classical terms. I comb my hair needs two arguments, but overtake, for instance, in the sense taking over, overtake, for instance, I overtake you on the road, has a two argument logical structure. I overtake a car. Okay. But if we say I take this over this other thing, if I use over independently from the verb, then we see that as a locative particle, it makes the verb need three arguments. Like all locative particles, for instance, not all locative particles, but I, for instance, if I say, I put the book on the table. I is an argument, book is another argument, and table is another argument that comes with the locative particle, which is, in this case, would be on the table. on. So over in itself is a three argument, a logical structure, a locative particle. But if we use it with the verb, it is a two argument logical structure. In this case, we would say that this locative particle has become an affix, a prefix, and is not an independent verb anymore. This is something that has been studied and analyzed in different languages, as we will see, especially in Old English, which was a very productive language. That's why we use this in this unit, because Old English was a period in the English language where a lot of derivation and suffixation occurred. Word formation phenomena were tremendous, incredible, incredibly big. Nowadays, the English language is also one of the most productive in creation of new forms ever in the world. But nowadays we have many other ways of creating new lexical items, which are not, even though it's still a very flexible language in the creation of new words, very dynamic, but nowadays it consists more of on the creation of acronyms, borrowings, neologisms, etc. It's more a trend in general in the world, but especially in English. Okay, continuing with this topic, another important concept is the idea of compositionality of the word. In role and reference grammar and in functional grammars in general, even in generative grammars, we talk about the compositionality of the sentence, the compositionality of clauses, the compositionality of the clause, which means that we have a nucleus in the word. In this case, if we talk about the word, the argument here is that we can apply this concept that has always been applied in linguistics to the clauses, to the word, because the word also has a nucleus, and then there are different elements that adjust to the word and add more meaning to the word, and these new attachments, these new forms, modify the nucleus. The nucleus modified by some items becomes the core, and then the core can also be modified by a periphery. So the more affixes we add, and the affixes in the surroundings will modify the whole core, and the core is also a modification of the nucleus plus elements that modify. So there is an example in the book, unpremeditatedly, no premeditadamente, and here we see that the nucleus would be meditate. Meditate is also a derived word, but in the let's focus on meditate. Here we have the nucleus, which becomes the core, premeditated, with the addition of an affix and a suffix, pre and ed, and then we have even from the core we have also more modifiers, which am and li. So here we have a very interesting example of what we mean by compositionality of the word. How do we analyze its derivational processes? Well, in this case, we have different concepts that are important that I want you to learn, or to ring a bell of, that you have an idea about these concepts. First of all, a derivational chain. The term derivational chain is what we do to represent the derivational process. In this case, the derivational chain would be when we include here, for instance, at the beginning, we have included one, two, or three. This would be a kind of derivational chain. Sometimes we can use this type of symbols to mean that from meditate, we have meditated, then we have premeditated, then we have premeditatedly, and then we have unpremeditatedly. So the derivational chain is here represented. And what do we do to see what comes first? if we don't want to look at the, we have seen this in Unit 2 also, that we can analyze the word formation phenomena synchronically or paradigmatically. When we look at the evolution in history, it's very simple. We see when a word appears. But if we want to analyze the history of a word on the synchrony, at this moment, for instance, a resource trick that I have always used is to analyze, for instance, frequency, to do a frequency analysis. Another one is, we saw that on Unit 2, and it's also recommended by many authors, consider the level of abstraction of a word. The more abstract it is, the more derivative will be. The more concrete, specific, the more the older will it be. For instance, the difference between paint and paint. Paint as a material and the action of painting. In this case, the action of painting is more abstract than the physical idea of a paint. So paint as will be, in this case, a derivative as a verb of the noun paint. Okay, this would be in cases of non-transparent phenomena very helpful. Another one, as I said, is the frequency analysis. A frequency analysis involves that we need to go to a corpus, such as the corpus of contemporary American English. For instance, we can also check the British National Corpus, the two main English corpora, and then we look for the words. The primitive or base word, in this case, meditate, a base word is the concept we use to mean the first word, the original word in the derivational chain. It is also called primitive, okay? So we see that it has the maximum number of results. Then we go and check for the second level, pre and ed. And we see that meditated has more results than premeditated. So then we can consider the ed more first, to have come first than premeditate. What is interesting here is that premeditated itself has many more results than the other two words, which can happen sometimes. So it's not always 100% sure. This method, that's why we need to mix it with other methods, such as this idea of abstraction. We see another interesting concept here when we analyze the derivational chain, which is the concept of recursion or recursivity. Recursion of recursivity or recursivity is just the idea of a word being derived once and then being derived again and then being derived again and again and again. So in this case, unpremeditatedly is a very derived word. So the phenomenon of recursion or recursivity is high in this case. Okay. The terminal predicate in this case is unpremeditatedly. The terminal word or terminal predicate. And the primitive or base word is meditate. Okay. So in this in different color, you see the words, the terms that we use in morphology to deal with this type of derivational processes, to mention them. There are, as I said, other types of affixes which are not existent in English, or they are not considered to be existent, which are infixes and circumfixes. McCarthy and Prince mention some examples in Tagalog language. Tagalog language, for some reason, has been very analyzed by linguists. It was very much on fashion in a period in the 90s. Probably it is because these linguists are American and they did field work all with the same tribe. Because Tagalog, if you have read the big red book of Van Belin of Roland Reference Grammar from the 1997, which was later on re-edited in 2005, is also based very much on this language in Tagalog and in other Native American Indian languages. But Tagalog is very frequently mentioned. So Tagalog has an infix, which is and creates an agent from a verb stem and appears before the first vowel of the word. For instance, from sulat, write, sumulat is one who wrote or one who writes. Okay, so this would be an infix. In Spanish, for instance, we also don't have infixes as far as I know, but we can consider the language maybe to have circumfixes. Circumfixes are phenomenons in which we have affixes that surround the word. So it's like a prefix and a suffix all together simultaneously. And they are considered circumfixes because they are considered that to occur together at the same time as a unit. Aronoff and Fudeman gave an example, Baird in 1998 gave an example from Indonesian, which is Kian, Kebeserean, Kebesearan, where Besar is big and Kebesaran is bigness, greatness. But it's quite challenging to state, and it will depend on the author, on the morphologist. We can say, for instance, that engrandecer in Spanish or enaltecer, for instance, are circumfixes because we don't use altecer and we don't also use enaltar or enalto, but we use enaltecer. So if these don't exist unless they are together, we can consider that they are circumfixes. Other important concepts that I would like you to remember is the idea of morph or allomorph. Depending on the author, they are used simultaneously or differently, but not differently. They are synonyms, I mean. Some authors use the word morph and other authors use the same, use the term allomorph. Allomorphs are the different realizations of phonetic realizations of one morpheme. For instance, in Spanish, mover muevo or mover movimiento, but then with the verb we say muevo. So mue, this phonetic realization is an allomorph of mov, of the root mov. Okay. It's called also called stem allomorphy. What is the difference? We saw this in unit 2 between stem and root. Stem and root can coincide because the stem is the basic unit to which another morphological piece is attached. So we attach to stem another morphological unit, but the root is the core initial word to which all the other pieces attach. So there is only one root, but we can have different stems. For instance, when there is a derivational chain or recursivity, the root will be always the first primitive word in the first term, the original one to which the first stem is attached, or that makes the first stem, but there can be other stems. An example is agree. From agree, where we have the root agree, we have agreement, but we also have disagree, we have disagreement. So imagine, from agree we create disagree, and from disagree we create disagreement. And from disagreement, we have disagreements. If we talk about, if we include the S for inflection. So disagree would be, agree would be the root, but also is the stem of disagree. And then disagree is the stem of disagreement, but it's not the root of disagreement. The root is always agree in all cases. Okay. So we can talk about simple stems and complex stems. Okay. So let's review. The basic concepts that we need to handle are stem, root, stem allomorphy, allomorph, morph, simple stem, complex stem. Here we are going to go also through different types of word formation processes in this point, in the third point, lexical change and word formation processes. So lexical change occurs through word formation processes or through word creation processes. For word formation processes, we have inflection and derivation. So we can have inflected words and derived words. Inflection has to do more with grammatical features, and derivation has to do more with derivational features. Grammatical features, the inflectional system of a language is what gives us the, as I said, the grammatical function of words, and derivation is the creation of new meanings in words. For instance, boring, or interesting. These are derivations, but interests or interested from I was interested is an inflection. But it, this is interesting is a derivation, okay? So this is helpful, this phenomena, the inflectional and the derivational phenomena of languages, especially the inflectional, the phenomena of languages, the inflectional capacity of languages, is interesting in the classification of languages. There are two ways of classifying languages: the genealogical or genetic classification of languages, or the typological or inflectional. The first one is the one that just classifies languages according to their origins. For instance, in our case, in English, both English and Spanish are Indo-European languages. And from Indo-European, we have different other languages. One of them is Germanic languages and Romance languages, Cyrillic languages. In the case of Germanic languages, they derived into North Germanic or West Germanic. And then North Germanic, for instance, would be Norwegian, Swedish, Finnish, and West Germanic would be English, basically English. That's why it's called, also considered Anglo-Saxon, from or West Germanic, in fact, English. We have also in Romance languages different type: Romanian, Spanish, Italian, etc. So this could be a genealogical or genetic classification of languages, analyzing our origins, origins going through roots. There are very interesting maps all over the world. You have seen this in other courses also. And then we have the typological classification of languages, which is organizing languages according to their inflectional capacity. And in this, we have four types of languages. We have the isolating analytic or root languages, and they go from the degree of being totally isolating or root languages, which means they don't have inflectional system, or going to polysynthetic or incorporating languages, which is the highest level of inflection, or synthesis. The degree of synthesis, so in the book you have different examples of these languages, of each of these languages. For isolating and analytic or red languages, we have, for instance, Chinese. These type of languages are languages in which every word has a meaning in itself. In this case, well, in English and Chinese, we have also tone to establish differences in meaning in sentences of words. They make use of tone on intonation. But in what is important is that they don't have an inflectional system. If they don't have an inflection, the less inflected a language is, the more order, word order or tone in this, in the case of Chinese, is important to identify grammatical meanings in the sentence. Then we have agglutinating or agglutinative languages, which are a bit more inflected, but not as much as inflective or fusional languages. Inflective languages would be, for instance, Latin or Spanish. And then polysynthetic or incorporating languages are the ones that are fully inflected. In only one term, all the inflectional, all the suffixes are adding a grammatical features, different types of grammatical features. we are not going to go through this very much in detail because in the book it is exposed quite clearly. The most important of this is that to understand that morphology is inflection, and the inflectional features of a language are the ones that provide grammatical meaning to the sentence. For instance, in English we have gender, no, we have tenses, plural or singular forms, but in Spanish, for instance, gender is also given through inflection. In languages where, for instance, in Spanish, the subject can be omitted or the word order is not as important because the word with its inflectional features is going to assume part of these grammatical meanings. But in English, word order is very important because we need a word in a certain position of the sentence to identify the grammatical meaning. This happens in Germanic languages, German, also a West Germanic language, which I forgot to say before, or Dutch, sorry, or English. How do we analyze? This is called the degree of synthesis of a language. How do we analyze this? Greenberg established an index, which appears in the book, which is a very simple index, which is taking a sentence, for instance, or a text, and then dividing all the syllables, all the minimum syllables, by the number of words. The higher an index of one would be the index of Chinese, and a root language, analytic, fully analytic, would be one, would be the index, because every word has a meaning, a grammatical or semantic, but every word has a meaning, and the more, the fewer the words, the amount of words by the amount of syllables. So in this case, the lower this number, the more synthetic the language will be. And we have to mention that these are just mere abstractions, okay? Because all languages have, in general, there are no extreme, apart from the examples given in the book, which is Eskimo and Chinese, the rest of the languages, Turkish, Spanish, Latin, English, can have different tendencies, depending on the context, on the text, on the period of the language, etc. So they are kind of abstractions. Well, this goes for inflection, and now we are going to focus on derivation. Derivation is another word formation process that has to do with more with lexical creativity and lexical creation. And there are different types of derivation. We have addition, when we add affixes. These affixes can be, as we have seen, prefixation, suffixation, infixation, or circumfixation. The last two very uncommon. Then we can have also abstraction, subtraction, or reduction. It is the same terms to refer to the same event, the same process, which is taking morphemes out. There are different types of reduction. For instance, in Spanish, when we say voy a ver la tele, tele is a clipping because the full word is television, but we say tele. From motocicleta, we say moto. Now it's very much on fashion to use clipping. It's something that sometimes I find not elegant, but I see it a lot. Nowadays it's a very modern, let's say, no? Sometimes it's for me a bit exaggerated, eh? But okay. Acronyms is also very much on fashion nowadays. For instance, UNED basically is an acronym of Universidad Nacional de Educación a Distancia. We are surrounded by acronyms everywhere. And blending is very common in English. For instance, branch, which is a mixture of breakfast and lunch. We also have the other example that appeared in the book was I forgot now, from leggings, which is jeans and I forgot. Sorry, but well, you can find examples and write them on the forum if you want. Then we have conversion, when we mute some changing in the vocalic structure of a syllable, or we can have also zero derivation or adding nothing. For this is very common in English. For instance, as we have said, something play, the play or play. The play as a theater play or play from the verb play, or it's very, very common in English, this lexicalization, verbalization or nominalization of lexical items. And then we have mutation, for instance, believe. In Spanish, we have, for instance, from previsión. From ver, we have be, vision, we have done a mutation. This is also very common in old English, this mutation. Vowels were very, had a big tendency to mutate. We have seen this, for instance, scarves, scarves. This would be a mutation. What is important here is also the idea of opaque word formation phenomena as opposed to transparent word formation phenomena. We have dealt with this in unit 2 also. We see that there are different principles and there you had some interesting ideas on how to find the primitive word or the base word and the terminal predicate. The base and the terminal predicate. and then we continue with point 4, which is word grammar, different approaches to the study of morphology. For this part, it is interesting to read some parts of the book from Herd Boy from 2007 or 2005. And in 2007, he did another edition, which is The Grammar of Words, An Introduction to Linguistic Morphology. He says, as we have seen at the beginning, that morphology deals with the internal structure of words. So it is a study of word grammar instead of sentence grammar. So it consists of a set of correspondence rules between form and meaning, a systematic description of morphological process, complex words, borrowing, phrases becoming words, word creation, word manufacturing, and morphological rules. So these are basically the parts that morphology, the discipline of morphology, studies. This was repeated. And then we have, as I said, there are some recent proposals for a model of morphology in grammar. We can see this in chapter 8 also in Boy, 2007. where we deal about the interaction between morphology and syntax. He says that morphology and syntax must be demarcated, but it is true that the distinction sometimes between syntax and morphology is quite blurry also, and it is difficult because, as we have seen, inflectional morphology gives grammatical information to the sentence. So it is difficult to see what comes, what we have to consider exclusively grammatical from the sentence or exclusively grammatical from the word, and not to see an interaction. There is always an interaction. But for Boy, he proposed the concept of lexical integrity, which he takes from the generativists, which says that this principle says that word constituents cannot be operated upon by syntactic processes. And this is what helps us identify the difference between grammar, syntax, and morphology. We have different proposals for a model of morphology in grammar. We have the generativists. The generativists have something that we need to recognize. We need to give them this recognition, which is they were the ones who devised the first explanatory models. They took the idea of word grammar from American structuralism, which is the origin of generativism, in fact, according to Williams 2007. And the generativists have proposed two important ideas. One is the lexicalist hypothesis, and then distributed morphology, which are two different branches in the study of morphology that we have in generativism. The lexicalist hypothesis involves, it's a lexeme-based approach. So it says that morphology does not reduce to morphosyntax. This branch says that syntax cannot look into morphology, and that both words and phrases have syntax, but this syntax is not the same as closed syntax. So they have different rules, they have principles that put the parts together, but they are not the same rules that that sentences have. For them, the idea is that the most important is the study of lexemes in this point of view. And then we have the distributed morphology branch, which is a morpheme-based approach, which considers that syntax and elements within syntax and within morphology enter into the same types of constituent structures. So they use the same structures to describe the grammar, both of words or of syntax. This is what has been followed, what has been taken from the generative position into the functional position for a model of morphology, because they also assume that these principles can be the same. So, functional grammarians or role and reference grammarian functionalists use some generativist ideas, such as the modular conception of language. This means the compositionality, as we have said before. Outer morphological properties of words are related to syntax, and inner properties are related to morphology. The application of the same principles, which is taken from distributive morphology, as I said. They say this, they use the same system of analysis and representation, but in different levels. The notion of a scope also, which is related to the modular conception of language, and the idea of word syntax, which is taken from American structuralism. The differences, generativists do not apply, as I said, the same principles of analysis in a word and in the clause, because according to them, they have different internal mechanisms, at least the lexical hypothesis, And the most important is that the difference between the functional theories and generative theories is that the functional theories are monostratal and generative theories are multistratal. This you have seen in other courses where the analysis of trees is different in one branch of linguistics and in another. We are going to see some examples here of functional trees, okay? In this unit, we use the unification and separation model of Martín Arista because it is a kind of combination of all the visions. On one hand, it uses the morpheme-based approach in the idea that the same principles can be applied from in syntax and in morphology, but in different levels, and also the idea that bound morphemes are lexical, as in distributed morphology. Bound morphemes are lexical items that contain their own independent entry in a database, for instance, and it also takes ideas from the lexeme-based approach, which is the idea of establishing paradigmatic patterns. We will see now what it is in the example of the some trees examples. Patterns are established in terms of templates that account for all grammatical aspects, and they have different simultaneous patterns can be represented at different operation operational constituents. We will see. Word structure can be manipulated both by syntax, one semantics, and pragmatics, and it also follows Everett because it unifies both inflection and derivation, the both processes in the meaning of the word. We are going to see now this with examples, okay? It separates on one hand, it unifies them into the meaning, but it separates them from the structural point of view, which we will see now in the representational point of view. Okay. What do we mean by establishing mixing all these constituents together? It means that there is a continuum by means of the operator and the constituent projections. We are going to see examples now of what we mean by operators and constituent projections. So there has not to, we solve the problem of having to establish a very big distinction and a dividing line between one thing or the other, between derivation and inflection. And this model uses the layered structure of the word as is used in Roland reference grammar to represent the layered structure of the course of the clause. So it has a nucleus, makes use of the periphery, it makes use of the core, it uses the same metalanguage as in Roland reference grammar. It also takes from functional grammar and functional discourse grammar, the idea of primitives and entities, the idea of lexemes, frames, and operators. So, according to this model, we could divide lexical entries or the lexicon into lexemes of two kinds, free or bound. This, as we have seen before, and also we can specify them into predicates with information, certain amount of information, their categorical combinatorial properties, their forms, the features that motivate these forms, their stems and their phonological representation. We can also include information on the distributional properties, their templates, their constructive templates. All this knowledge and all this model was applied in the development of a lexicological database of Old English, which was NERFUS. NERFUS now, for some reason, is not reachable online. It's in its third version. I myself contributed to the creation of NERFUS in the first version already back in 2006. And I can assure you that we followed all this model in the sense of practically what we did was we took a word, with the FileMaker program that later on has an interface that shows with the interface to the user is different, but the inside is in a FileMaker database, we included the root, the base word, let's say, the root and the stem in one field. And then we had to include all these features that we have here in different areas of the database. So for each lexical item, we had to include their different umlauts, their different conversions, their different stems, stem allomorphs, the suffixes they had, the prefixes they added, the meaning they had with the each of the suffixes and which each of the prefixes, the function of this suffix or prefix in the lexical item, whether it was a part of the operator projection or of the constituent projection, which means whether they were bound morphemes, free morphemes, the meaning they were giving to the word, basically, and all these different layers. This we did word by word. In my case, I was in charge of the verbs of Old English, which are around, I think it was between 5,000 and 7,000 verbs. So I did all the verbs. Other colleagues of mine did the adjectives, others did the nouns, etc. So we are going to go directly to the representation to of all this theory with examples. So this tree, this kind of tree, would be let's say the template for the representation of different words. So we would have the predicate here, which could be the same as the stem allomorph or the word, the root or the stem. Then we will have the nucleus, which could be the linguistic representation, the core, which could be in case this has some affix or suffix, then surrounding, then it would mean a core, and then we could have the final word if in case there is even more recursivity. The representation of the some parts of the inflectional derivation and some parts of the affixal derivation, create the derivation that is through word formation phenomena apart from inflection, is represented by operators. And these operators can work on the level of the nucleus, on the level of the core, or on the level of the word, depending on the function of this operator. We are going to see examples now. For instance, how do we represent a complex word? A complex word in this case is what we would say of normally, generally, a compound. A compound has a nucleus, and this nucleus is composed, this compound has, in this case, three nucleus. It has a main core, and it is composed of, in this case, two words, two main words, okay? Two main arguments that go to the nucleus. The root would be ring, in this case, but both bel and estre are arguments of the word, because both bel and ringer are two different words if we put them apart. So here we are accounting for compounding. On one hand, we would have the argument of bel, and in the other hand, we would have the argument of este, or in this case would be an argument of the nucleus ring. Altogether, they would form the core, and the core in this case is similar to the complex word. Here we have only constituent projection. The constituent projection shows us that the nucleus in this case, the main nucleus would be nuc, the solar ring, and to this nucleus we attach two different arguments, which two different meanings. One of the action, ringer, in this case ER, and then of specifying the what it rings, which is a bell in this case. In here we have a derivation, a prefix through prefix, and we have a complex word also, which has an argument adjunct. An argument adjunct is in role and reference terms, role and reference grammar, reference grammar terms, is a semi-argument in the sense that it's not a adjunct because it's part of the argument structure, but it gives adjunctal information. This is very typical for locative particles, what that we were talking about before. It's kind of, it stands between argument and adjunct, let's say. Here we have up, up astigan, which could be go up, where up in this case is a word in itself, but in this case it's not working as a compound, it's working as a derivation, that's why it it's an argument adjunct and not an argument itself. So here we would have compounding, because bell and estre are arguments, but here we would have derivation because up is an argument action. Okay. Here we have, for instance, periphery and core complex word inner secretary, in reiterating. In this case would be part of the periphery, because it's only modifying secretary. Is not part of the essential meaning of the word, so we could delete it and we would still have a full meaning of the word ritere. That's why it's called a peripheral adjunct, which is a word in itself. And here in the complex word, we would have the main core, what gives the argument, it would be ere, the derivational suffix ere, which is. It's the argument itself because it is what is giving to this root the function of the word. In this case, it is a noun, and this is given through the suffix ere. And here we have, for instance, accumulation of semantic elements represented in a single form. Here we can see this in the projector, in the not in the constituent projection, but in the operator projection below. Here we have OA, which is toga leader. A, this A is an in the, as a constituent. It's what is giving the name of the function of the word, noun. But also it has information about the number, about the gender, and about the case. So if we represent the operator projection, we see here that the inflectional information, this suffix is given, is of three kinds, and each of these types of inflectional information goes on a different layer of the constituent of the operator projection. Okay, the number would go to the core, and the gender and the case would go to the complex word, which is more to the outside. So what is important is to know that operators are functional levels, which may be realized in the constituent projection as lexical arguments or not. We have here, for instance, for Kuman, as come before, where for has a projection in the constituent projection because the meaning of for has not been lost semantically, and in for Kuman as destroy, where for has already been lexicalized into Kuman, inside Kuman, where for doesn't have an actual lexical meaning in the constituent projection, but it gives in the operator projection the idea of transitivity. So as you can see, this model allows for the distinction between different derivational cases with different semantic processes as here, okay? Where it helps us account for different processes of lexicalization. Okay? And finally, some interesting resources that I wanted to show you, and we don't have time to check more, but it's interesting, and I wanted to call the attention to you on first the fact that in the NERTHUS project, the page that you have in the book has changed a bit. So the new lexicological database of Old English now is not available for some reason, but this is the link. Dash NERTHUS in NERTHUS project, and when you go to NERTHUS project, they have devised this research group a parallel corpus of Old English versus English. So now they have a lexicological database of Old English where all this morphological information is included, and about derivation and inflection of all the terms of Old English, all lexical items in Old English, but also there is a parallel corpus, which is another interesting database. And it is interesting also another database that has been developed. Well, the Serre Morphology Group has devised a lot of databases and really encourage you to check at this webpage, SMG Serre Act UK, because they have like 12 databases on different rare languages and on different types of morphological interests, let's say, whether it is inflection or derivation, many types. So I encourage you to check this webpage for more information. Here are the references that I have been mentioning here in this presentation about Hengewald. Well, I didn't mention them, but you have them here about functional linguistics, functional grammar that was developed by Dick, Simon Dick, and his followers, Hengewald, Mackenzie, Mayra Luzon and Perignan Pascual, together with Faber, or Paco Cortés, Francisco Cortés, were the developers of the lexical grammatical model, which is part of the functionalists, together with Martin Arista, Van Veilin, and Gert Boyg is a generativist, and still he has a very interesting book about morphology, which is the first one that you have here in the reference list. So that was all by now. I hope you found this interesting, that I could help you understand a bit more about Unit 3, which I know is very dense. For this reason, if you have any other doubts or any questions or comments, please use the forum for Unit 3. That was all by now. See you in the next session. Bye.